the policy regarding population definitions, and the matrix, matrix looks kind of heavy, but if you get into it, it's actually quite clear. I was pleased to see that. So San Francisco has adopted definitions for each of the three primary populations that experience homelessness and for whom San Francisco has created dedicated access points and system resources: adults, families, and transitional age groups. Each definition includes three elements: a description of what constitutes the household type, their required connection to San Francisco, and a definition of applicable housing or homelessness status. As much as possible, these definitions will align with one another so that the same concepts like fleeing violence are defined in the same way and have similar documentation requirements. All people experiencing homelessness are covered by at least one household type. So that's actually really important. Someone could technically fall into all three categories depending on their situation. It really depends on the resources they're looking for and what their current presentation is to determine which path they could take or which definition they would choose to consider themselves under. So persons who meet more than one household type definition, for example, a parenting transitional age youth could access services across the systems, may be served in the community system. These are not the same as the eligibility requirements for any specific program. So this is the broadest definition of eligibility for any services. Specific programs might have narrower eligibility once a person gets into the system. And this is also important. Transfer policies allow households who are housed within the resources of one system to be moved to a more suitable size unit of program that's available through another population system without having to be reassessed or reprioritized. A household that is priority status in one system and moves to another due to a change in household type will retain their status for the 90 days during which the priority status designation is active. On a case-by-case basis, based on need and availability, HSH may consider extenuating circumstances that are raised by an access point or by a household and determine to serve a household of one type within a different system in order to accommodate specific needs. This process must include a write-up of circumstances and a determination by HSH to waive the applicable population definition in order to better serve the household. So that, we don't know what that looks like yet. That's basically if someone would like to access services in a different system and it is not clear that they meet the eligibility requirements, they're essentially asking for a waiver. And I can get more information about that later too. Does anyone have any questions about, like, yes?
Yeah, I have a question. Do you guys work for the community process?
This has gone through multiple stages. I'm not sure what the community process aspect of it was, but I can find out and get back to you. Once my colleagues are here, they might have a better idea of that as well. I know that this has gone through about 16 different stages of input from various people, and I'm not sure what the community process was. Do you have a question?
Someone goes into a coordinated entry site and the whoever's seen them is like, you would fall under multiple categories if there's like a process that folks at the sites are discussing, like it may be better for you to go to a family site rather than a day site or something like that. Or if you have a young person with a child, also with like a teenager with a child also.
Yeah, that conversation should be happening in the context of the eligibility conversation. Solving. In general, if a person has a minor in their custody, the family system is going to have more appropriate resources for them. So that's something that is definite that should be discussed. If a person has a child that isn't in their custody, then that changes things a little bit too. In terms of like TAE versus adult systems, if a person's eligible for both, it's really where they feel the most comfortable. And also, the goal is to have a conversation about what resources are available so that a person can make an informed decision before they get too involved in down a particular path. But a person can change, like a person can switch between systems at any time. It just depends on the circumstances.
And will they get, will the different systems know, the different systems will know that they've been assessed in like pay or family or adult or adult?
Yes. Yes, so that is one thing that's visible, and one is if a person has gone to the family system and completed an assessment, completed or, you know, enrolled in that system and then comes into an adult access point, the staff at the adult access point can see that the person has touched the family system. So they probably have a conversation about that as well.
So this,
the person behind you, actually.
Can you give an example of transferring systems?
So kind of what we were just talking about, if a person loses custody of their child or regains custody of their child in the morning, or if they could move between the adult or TAE and family system. If a person is engaged with the adult system and they decide that they would prefer to work with a TAE provider and they're eligible to work with the TAE provider based on their age and circumstances, they can switch systems, basically.
And is there anything more transparency around the eligibility to score?
Let me just write that down because I want to follow up on it really quick. So this doesn't have anything to do with the assessment itself. This is just about eligibility for services within the homelessness response system and basically determining what we mean when someone is defined as experiencing homelessness for San Francisco. The assessment itself is one component of prioritization. The score is, I think that, to speak a little candidly, the score was kind of pumped up as this defining thing when we were first launching coordinated entry. And at this point, it's actually just one factor of how someone could be prioritized. The assessment questions themselves are available. But the scoring isn't available to, like, the actual breakdown of the scoring isn't available even to the people who are administering the assessment. So that's something that I can continue to take back as a thing that people are asking for, and I will take it back to the department. But at this point, it's still internal just to HSH.
Okay,
mine
is not scored.
Oh, I know.
I have the same problem she had. I went to 123 10th Street and I've been a client there. And they do read the assessment. And the end of the whole assessment. And I know she's been homeless for about 15 years. Mm-hmm. And of course, anyone who is being homeless, sleeping in the street, suffer trauma or any kind of these kind of issues, you know? So, for the traumatic experiences. So so when she's going to explain all the things about her situation to the day working for HSH, so they say, you don't qualify. You don't make any points. So I don't understand what it means make it, the points. I don't understand how this woman, already with disabilities, and sleeping in a chair in Oshun Center, every day for over 7-8 years, mm-hmm. there in the shelter. So it's ridiculous when she's going to do the assessment. They tell you don't qualify for housing, you don't qualify for any of the services we provide to you. So basically, we walking out empty. I don't want to argue with the lady who's working there, right, telling her that when I'm bringing this issue to you guys, because I still feel the new coordinator of entry is not working. It's not only for them, there's many singles are walking down there, and they happen the same thing. Families, the same thing, working specifically with families, the same thing. Families were living in Dalaba, in other conditions. Families were living in SRO hotels. So we're facing so many issues, so many problems with these families, and the families are homeless too. So, and that's the reason I asked the first question. So, if you went to the community process with this document, because I think and I believe the community can support in this process and give you input if they agree that we want to move you for this direction. If it's not, so we have to look for other avenues. But really, for me, it's more important to the community supporting this process that I say why they can, because it's not work.
Well, and to speak to that really quick, I'm not sure if there was a community process. This, most of the work that was done on this was done before I joined this team and was working on this project. So it could be that there was a community process that I'm not aware of. I'm just not sure that if there was a community process, what it looked like. And to speak to what happened at the access point, that is disturbing on multiple levels, right? Because it's not just, oh, this person wasn't prioritized, and that's concerning. It's also, this person wasn't prioritized and they left empty-handed, feeling like there was absolutely nothing available for them, which is not how those interactions are supposed to go. So that's feedback that I'll take back as well. But in general, if a person is not prioritized, that shouldn't be the end of the conversation, and they shouldn't be leaving feeling like there's nothing available for them. Even though the problem-solving resources we have and the other resources we have in the system don't work for everyone, they are still available. So it should never just be like, there's nothing, you're done, this conversation is over. So I'm sorry that happened, but I will follow up on that. And also the other thing that you said about how the score was too low, so you couldn't be reassessed. People can be reassessed every 6 months or if their situation changes. So that's always available. And in general, we're working on a couple pilot programs to really take a look at who isn't being prioritized and why. The thing that we've heard consistently throughout the community is that there are a lot of people, like you're the person you're describing, who is chronically homeless and experiencing a high level of vulnerability and trauma and other barriers, and they're not being prioritized, in part because we don't have the resources to actually house everyone who meets the criteria, but also because the assessment as it's working now isn't really capturing and prioritizing all the people who need who are having that experience. So the department is looking at that from a couple different directions, and I'm hoping that in the next few months we can share more information about how that's going. But as of right now, it's in the very early stages. So it's moving in that direction, but slowly.
The other thing, sorry to interrupt you, but the other thing, last week, a mom lost a baby. She's pregnant. She's homeless. And she was sleeping in the streets. She's had a 6 month pregnant. So for whatever the reason, the paramedics come and take her to the hospital. So later, a couple hours later, the baby died. So basically, she's with the baby. It's a traumatic situation. This is one thing. Other thing is making me worry and thinking about so many times asking these questions is because all people who is homeless, who is poor, families, children, so dying in the streets, dying. Another side of this picture, we have families which lose the babies too, as in detention center. You know, so it's ridiculous that we cannot help these families take it out from the system and bring it back to the regular life. The other thing is the families with the kids dying, the single man's dying. I'm walking right now on the Turkey Street between Living World and High. A gentleman died. I've seen that. They don't die. This is not really okay.
No, I hear you.
You know, so we have to do something with these folks. We have a super trauma, super many other kind of issues to provide housing. This is what they need. And the only way we can help in these folks to study, make a program, doing things to recover and become better. But if you don't have a place to live, it's impossible for any human being we hope to overcome.
Exactly, and that's part of the problem is that there aren't enough resources to actually help everyone.
I'm sorry, guys.
No, it's okay.
Has been in this thing.
So are there any other questions or comments about the initial intro? Because I think we could jump into the actual definitions. So on the second page, each definition has three components: household composition, San Francisco connection, and housing or homelessness status. A household must meet all three components to qualify for services in the homelessness response system. So these are broken up. The first one is household composition and or characteristics. That determines which system you're eligible to receive services in. The way that this is set up, each row that's broken across in the chart should be exactly the same across the entire row. So for example, an individual age or not exactly the same, but covering the same situation. So in the adult system, an individual age 18 or over who is living in a household of one or more people without minor children, or an individual under 18 who has been legally emancipated, is the definition of the household composition for adults. For families, it's one or more adults with physical and legal custody of one or more minor children, or one or more adults in a household, which includes a person who's in the third trimester of pregnancy or who is 5 or more months pregnant and the pregnancy is medically determined to be high risk, or one or more adults with one or more minor children not currently in their custody who are expected to reunify in less than 90 days and have a letter from Child Protective Services stating that the only barrier to reunification is their lack of shelter or housing. Then for TE, it's an unaccompanied individual between the ages of 18 and 24, or an unaccompanied individual under 18 who has been legally emancipated, or an unaccompanied individual between the ages of 25 and 27 who first entered youth targeted services in San Francisco when in an age category above. So who first entered youth targeted services in San Francisco when between the ages of 18 and 24, or under 18 and legally emancipated. Any questions about household composition?
Yeah.
Yes?
So it's about, let's say the family. The second part, they say one more adult in the household, which includes a person who is in the third trimester pregnancy. So you guys are still using the third trimester pregnancy. You don't change it to give you the opportunity the man who is become pregnant in the moment to cover the full services?
Not at this point. And Elizabeth's going to speak more about the pregnancy policy after we're done with this. So she can definitely answer more questions about that. But it's an adult who's in the third trimester of pregnancy or who is 5 or more months pregnant and the pregnancy is high risk.
That's pretty much the same thing that we was having in the past. This is not helping the man. For example, I never be pregnant because I'm not a woman. Right? I want to speak for them.
Okay.
I want to speak for them. So, if I be a woman and I'm being pregnant tomorrow, what happened to me? I stay in touch with myself since the first year I know I am pregnant and being have everything to accommodate my system to helping my baby. So growing up my tummy all these months with all commodities. Place to live, resting, food, everything. What happened to these months? We don't have house, we don't have nothing. And being pregnant and the baby is growing up in the tummy without any support. I believe every woman who becomes pregnant the first day, they need the full support. We cannot wait in 4, 5, 6, 7 months when we want to provide the support. That's the reason we're losing the baby. That's the reason the mom is losing the baby. That's the reason they suffer trauma and the stress. Because they don't have a place they can take care of the baby with developing and becoming. So it's a serious issue that what I see right here. So why do we have to dictate to the woman when they need to receive the services? But they're supposed to receive the service the first day when they become pregnant. Probably you guys think that I'm wrong. You can correct me. But honest to you, if I become pregnant today, for example, if you're a woman, I hire it for myself, right? But that woman don't have nothing.
Thank you for your feedback. We're going to keep moving, and then Elizabeth will talk more about it when we're done with this. So the second eligibility component is San Francisco connection. For all three populations, the definition is staying in San Francisco at least one of the last 7 nights. For the family system, it also includes having one or more children enrolled in school, preschool, or childcare in San Francisco. So if that's the case, the family does not actually need to be staying in San Francisco over the last 7 nights. Or has a head of household who is currently or formerly a ward of San Francisco who currently resides in another county. That also applies to the TAE system. So for TAE, the client needs to have either stayed in San Francisco at least one of the last 7 nights, or currently or formerly be a ward of San Francisco who is currently residing in another county. Does that make sense? Yes.
I just wanted to ask about the age, the 18 to 24. I know that some providers can do up to 27 or 28, I think. So it fluctuates the pay age.
So the 25 to 27 range comes into play with certain programs. But if a person is between 25 and 27 and they were previously engaged in services with a TAE provider, they can still access services through the TAE system. They might not be eligible for all of the TAE-specific programs that exist, but there are some that will accept people who were previously engaged with TAE, with the TAE system, who have aged up, not necessarily out, but are not yet 27, but are older than the 25.
I'm wondering why some programs are doing up to 27 without having any experience.
Are there?
It would be nice if it was just like consistent in the city.
Are there programs that are serving a TAE specific population up to 27 that are taking new participants after the age of 24? Okay, I don't know of any of them. So if you guys do, by all means, let me know and I can follow up on. So then the third component is the homelessness definition. And this includes categories of currently literally experiencing homelessness. And then there are some additional categories that apply to the family and TAE system for being at imminent risk of homelessness or at risk of chronic homelessness. So the first category is has a primary nighttime residence that is a public or private place not meant for human habitation. So that would be outdoors. In this case, one thing that's been brought up to me multiple times is that an RV is actually a place that's meant for people to live, but it would still count for this. Outdoors in a car, in a garage, all of the things that we think of that would fall under this. The second category is living in a publicly or privately operated shelter designated to provide temporary living arrangements, including congregate shelters, transitional housing, and hotels and motels paid for by charitable organizations or by federal, state, and local government programs. So if a person's in a stabilization room, if they're staying in a shelter, if they're staying in transitional housing, it would count in this second category. And then the third has been residing in an institutional care facility, including a jail, substance abuse or mental health treatment facility, hospital, or other similar facility for fewer than 90 days and was homeless in shelter, a place not meant for human habitation, or fleeing or attempting to flee domestic violence before entry. So for this category, it is very similar to the federal definition where the person had to be homeless upon entry and be in the institution for less than 90 days. Page. This is also the same across all three populations. Fleeing or is attempting to flee domestic violence, dating violence, sexual assault, stalking, or other dangerous or life-threatening conditions that relate to violence against the individual or a family member in the primary nighttime residence, or has made the individual afraid to return to their primary nighttime residence. And A, has no other residence, and B, lacks the resources of support networks, such as family, friends, or faith-based, or other social networks to obtain other permanent housing. or family will imminently lose their primary nighttime residence, provided that one, residence will be lost within 14 days of the date of application for homeless assistance. Two, no subsequent residence has been identified. And three, the individual or family lacks the resources or support networks needed to obtain other permanent housing. So the imminent risk of homelessness definition will cover families and TIG. Yes?
I have a question for those homeless category one adult. On page three, the third column, I just wanted to know if that was a pop or on CSCI. If the person before they came into our CSCI was, sounds like it would, because it says institutional care facility, including hospital or other similar facility, for fewer than 90 days, but was in a shelter or homeless experience prior.
That would be our story. And then the last is at risk of chronic homelessness. This is from the No Place Like Home Initiative. So this, I believe, is possibly, one second. Okay, this is the same across all three. It's just that the columns are slightly different width, so it looks a little different. So this applies to all three systems, and it would apply to an individual who is at high risk of long-term or intermittent homelessness, diagnosed with serious mental illness and or chronic substance use, exiting institutionalized settings, including but not limited to jail and mental health facilities, who were homeless prior to admission, and A, has no other residence, and B, lacks the resources of support networks such as family, friends, and faith-based or other social networks to obtain permanent housing. So this is actually very similar to the one that Miguel was just asking about, but the difference with this one is there's no time limit attached. So this category would apply to someone who was homeless at the point of admission to an institution, but has been there for 90 days, and then fits A and B, has no other residence, and lacks the resources of support. So right now the DP system is outside of HSH. We're working on posting and then hiring a DP coordinator position, but the system itself will still remain separate. So the staff working at the access points should be able to refer people to DP networks. I don't know how that's happening in real time. So if you have had any experiences with that, I can definitely take that feedback back. But that's what should be happening at this point. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. Okay. Two separate information systems because we want to keep clients' information confidential if they're experiencing DV. But again, if folks are experiencing DV, they should still access those resources and make it known to the person who's working with them at the access points.
Okay.
Yeah, so regarding about mental health, what we was talking about in this document, I think you guys have to hire a professional personnel with enough experience to work in with families or singles. So I have a valid reason why I say that. So and because my own experience too, being formerly homeless, long, many years ago. So anyway, I had the opportunity to work in with families or singles to do the assessments, either way, for the families of 123 Tennessee Street, so for singles. And I see half of the folks who is working there, really young, probably just get up from the university and starting working there. That people don't have, I don't want to criticize the people at any levels, but I want to be clear, that people don't have experience working with homeless people who suffer trauma, different multiple traumas, and including the families and the youths, or simple, the youths too. So we have to have people with experience, really. So I don't want to use my experience in these kind of situations, but I want to share it with you guys. I have PTSD. I've been in therapies for 25 years, and I am still in therapies. It's people, human beings who is homeless, they cannot recover from one day to the next day. It's not true. For 1 year, 2 years, it's not. They need time, years to heal, and then become better. But really, we need people professional. And this is specific in IC. Yeah.
Okay, if there aren't any more comments or questions at this point, I'm going to hand it off to either Claire or Elizabeth, whoever wants to go first. Yes?
I'm going to make sure that before things, like, in general, with people are discharged, to prioritize them before they leave.
Yes.
Any coordination with that?
Yeah, so at this point, people are, access point staff are going out and assessing people at general, in the jails and in other inpatient settings. Not that the jails are inpatient settings, but you know what I mean. And they're being assessed and prioritized before they're discharged.
All right, thank you. Just to introduce myself for folks who don't know me, my name is Elizabeth Medina, and I work with the Department of Homeless and Supportive Housing as a program manager for family shelter and family transitional housing. So I'm one of the people that's been working on updating our protocol as it relates to working with folks that are pregnant. So the definition that you have in the handout in front of you is the definition as it is right now. Whether that's going to be the definition forever, you know, there's still a lot of conversation and community engagement around it. And so I want us to keep an open mind in terms of how we see the definition around pregnant people, and I'll get more into that in just a second. And so really our work around updating our pregnancy policy has been around folks that are unsheltered and pregnant. And so if for folks that have custody of other children, they already go through the family system and are able to access shelter, problem solving, and other housing opportunities that they're eligible for. It's the folks that don't have custody of other kids and are unsheltered and are pregnant is really the work that we're trying to do. And so what we're trying to do for the folks who don't currently meet the family definition is to seek to accommodate them within our existing portfolio. So what that looks like and what is actually being implemented right now is, for example, is at SF HOT, our homeless outreach team, or if the police encounter an unsheltered pregnant person, they will bring them into the first available shelter placement. And oftentimes the first available shelter placement is within our adult portfolio. So it's within the NAS centers, it's within, the HOT team has its own beds within adult shelter. And so it's really seeking to accommodate people in the first available placement. And so that's basically looking at our entire portfolio, including NAV Center, most of the NAV Centers have clinics on site, and so we seek to connect people immediately to the clinic in order to get pregnancy and other another healthcare that they need. And so with that proof of pregnancy, they can actually extend their stay. And so what we're seeking to do is to have that person be sheltered, first of all, that's our primary goal, and then second, connect them to services, both the clinics on site and then also to the access points. And one of the things that we really want to keep in mind is that folks have choices, right? And so if folks are choosing to engage in the adult system, we also want to respect that. They can engage the adult access point, and if they get prioritized within the adult system, we're seeking to house them as soon as possible, really. And so if the person then is assessed in the adult system and prioritized and housed, great, we accomplished our goal. If they're still in the shelter placement, one of the things that we're seeking to do is to have them connect with the family system as soon as they meet that family definition. That's what we're doing right now. Again, this is still in the very early stages of implementation, and we're still learning, and we still haven't released a final protocol. This is a way of trying to serve the people that are right in front of us while we're developing the process and the policy. So once the person meets the family definition, they're connected to the family coordinated entry system, they're engaging in services through the access points. And another key component that we're already implementing and that isn't part of the pregnancy protocol but is very central to this work is transfers. And so we're already implementing transfers within for shelter placements. So when someone, for example, if they're a Tay and they're in Tay transitional housing, but now they're 23 and they're pregnant and they need the family definition, we want to be able to transfer them to the family system without them having to start over from zero. Makes sense, right? All right, cool. So that's also what we're seeking to do in terms of shelter placement. So we want to make smooth transitions for people when their family composition changes or there's a change in eligibility, especially if we know that these are folks that are prioritized and they're folks that we're trying to house. So transfers is going to be a critical piece of our response to unsheltered pregnant people. The other thing that I want to say regarding the definition is that HSH is currently in conversations with the Coalition on Homelessness and their leadership, as well as leadership from other providers, to get their feedback on how things are going, ways that we can better support unsheltered pregnant people. Ultimately, our goals are really aligned and the same in that we don't want pregnant people to be unsheltered, and we don't want pregnant people to be unconnected to services. So our goal is to get people inside and get them connected to services. Okay, questions? Yes.
I'm sorry, I'm talking too much, but I have to put in the stance you prefer. When you're talking about the pregnancy, you're talking about connecting the families to services, or they can go to a simple shelter.
We're saying one.
We have waiting list, almost 200 families going into shelter. We don't have enough beds for shelter. This is one thing. But we have another picture. This is the Thomas Pino program report to us. We have almost 200 homeless families present. How we want to accommodate these families with pregnant in a shelter when we don't have any space that we can put at the rest in there? This is a problem, right?
So if I can interrupt you for just a second, because I want to address the pieces of data that you've already talked about. So I want to issue a slight correction. So we have about 214 people that are awaiting individual room shelter. While folks are awaiting individual room shelter, they are able to access congregate beds in the family system. Whether they choose to go to those congregate beds or not, that's, you know, up to personal choice. But the 200-ish, you know, fluctuates on any given day. That's for individual room shelter. So I want to offer that as a correction to the data that you've presented. I've been personally looking at the data in terms of adults, youth, and families that report having a pregnant person within their household. At least for the family system, we see about, on average, 5 to 7 new pregnant people every given month that show up at the access points. And so that's the data that we're seeing, and we're very closely tracking this data. We're also making changes to the one system in order to better, in order to better match people to the services that they need as they become eligible. To give you an example, for Tay in the one system, it's a kind of a live marker, so the person, it'll calculate it based on their birthday, it'll calculate their age. We want something very similar where we can calculate due date rather than having static data that doesn't really help us in terms of supporting a person as they're nearing their due date. But you're right, our inventory is not enough and we can always use more.
Yeah, we have 1,000 single waiting, the singles and the waiting list. So to get in a shelter, all the things you mentioned, so that the women who are not taking go to a next door to single shelter. Why do you want to do this for mom, for the new mom, we want to be mom, so to go to this shelter, when we had the obligation to create and build a new shelter for these women with need. So you know, we don't have enough beds for the mothers. And we have to do something about that.
Yeah, and I'm in full agreement with you. We don't have enough, and oftentimes what we have is less than ideal. But we are seeking to accommodate people in what is first available. And right now what we're doing is most often accommodating people within the navigation centers because they are 24/7 access. They have access to a clinic, and they also have access to storage, and their partners can stay with them. So for most of the clients that we're serving right now, the navigation center is actually one of the better options of the options that are available. Other comments, thoughts, recommendations?
So I have a recommendation for you.
Yes.
I mentioned to her earlier. My recommendation is, I don't want you guys or the city decide to give the time to the moms with pregnant to the 6, 7, or 8 months. So you know the person trimester to be in receiving assistance from you guys when they're supposed to assist them and the first day when they become pregnant. So really, come on. It's a new mom, probably a young new mom. They want experiencing the whole process and experiencing the whole process waiting 7 months when she's gonna get services from the city. This is ridiculous, right? So we have to do something.
I will definitely take the lead.
I worked in the family system for over 10 years. I think this is a super important issue that you raised, but every discussion that we're basically having here comes to the fact that there's not enough resources. And so I think everyone agrees in this room that the first day someone is pregnant, they should be able to enter the family system. But unfortunately, what the choice you're making then is that a pregnant woman with no child, one person, goes into a room that fits 3 people. So basically what you're saying is you'd rather have a pregnant mom in there than the person with 2 little children. I'm not saying which one is right or wrong. But at every step of this game, that's the line we're drawing. We have to make a decision who we're going to prioritize because there's not enough resources. So I just want to really point that out. I think everyone in here is on the same page, but it's a resource issue. I think we all think there should be more shelter, there should be more housing. It's unreasonable for anybody to be sleeping on the street. But what the city is trying to do, and I think needs to take your guys' input, but at some point somebody's going to be told you can't get the space, right? So you have to decide that you're going to tell the mom with the 2-year-old or the pregnant mom who doesn't get to go in. And either way, it's brutal, but that's basically what these guys are trying to do here. And I think you guys should continue to give feedback, but it's not like we can do it all. So at some point, there's always a hierarchy. People have questioned the scoring and things like that for the vulnerability stuff. I think it's reasonable to question the scoring, but that's why that tool exists, is because there's not enough resources. So we've decided as a community, and the HUD and the federal government has decided that the people who are most vulnerable, the most chronically homeless, are going to get access to the system first. And so that's what that score allows them to do. It's not a perfect system, and there's people looking into this all over the country.
And I'm sorry to respond to you, but one thing is, the baby's dying.
No, I know.
No, I'm just. This is the big thing for me, like putting down right here, because the baby dying. This is one of the things we need to think about it. So, what happened to the baby? So you wanna do something, right? You wanna respond or react to whatever the things you wanna do to fixing or solving this problem. So, come on. But I understand, I got you. Thank you.
I got you too.
Your recommendation.
Thank you both. And I've written down your comments and we'll definitely be taking them back. So, thank you. So, next up, unless there's anything else on the pregnancy policy, we have Claire to talk about. Housing locators
So it's going to be a scattered site program all throughout the city. Each person is going to be assigned a case manager through one of the four Rising Up partners. And so and we're really going to focus on once someone is housed and stable to do professional workforce development with them. So it's a really exciting program, and we just started the referral process last month. And so we made 20 referrals in September and hope to make another 20. So when we started coordinated entry, we wanted to do a BLITZ type assessment, much like the adult system. So we set some goals for ourselves. We wanted to assess 300 youth, open up all the six access points, which I think a gentleman back here touched on that, you know, we're having a hiring crisis in San Francisco in terms of there are not enough people who are able to live on the wages that we pay. And so they're all staffed up now, which I'm very proud of. It was a very long process. And so we wanted to assess 300 youth, with 60 of those youth being LGBTQ and 25 of those being TGNC, transgender, gender non-conforming. And so we achieved those goals in July, on July 31st. So we exceeded our assessment list goals. We reached 312 youth, and that number has just been steadily climbing as the access points are getting more familiar with their role and doing outreach and things of that nature. So we have 718 youth assessed total since the adult list last November to now. And so I really want to talk about the data and what we found based on the demographic composition of these youth that we have served through coordinated entry. And I also just want to do a big shout out. There was a 10% reduction in youth homelessness during the 2019 PIT count. So that was due to, you know, the hard work that all of our youth survey organizations are doing in partnership with HSH to really help resolve youth homelessness. There are some interesting statistics with race. So in the there are about 47 Black / African American folks that are enrolled in coordinated entry, compared to 29% of those represented in the PIT count. I contribute that that variance to having a presence in Bayview to really serve that community that where homelessness kind of looks different than it does here in the Central City. What I really wanted to do, my goal was, is to have these representations be proportional, but also to be able to tell a story of, like, what does youth homelessness in San Francisco actually look like? And so for the rest of the statistics, they're pretty much on par, 25% white in coordinated entry, 23% white during the PIT count, 3% Asian in both, 3% Native American in coordinated entry, and 2% in the PIT count, and so on. And so we do have 15% of data not reported, which is a little frustrating for me, but that is people's personal choice, and they're allowed to report whatever they feel comfortable with at the time. And the next thing is ethnicity, so folks of Latinx descent. So there were 75% of the youth that were assessed are non-Latinx, whereas in the PIT count, it was 68%. And so there are 28% Latinx folks that are represented in coordinated entry as of right now. And the PIT count is slightly higher. So we are doing concerted outreach to those communities. And so if anyone has recommendations at the end of this presentation, I would truly appreciate it. And so the next one, the interesting thing is gender. So while we did reach our goals for surveying 25 transgender, gender non-conforming folks, it really did not match up to what the pay count was. So there are about 8% of youth experiencing homelessness in San Francisco are gender non-conforming or transgender, whereas we only got about 3.5% represented in the coordinated entry data. So we understand that we have a huge gap in serving that community. So what we're doing is Mayor Breed had an initiative to help serve more transgender youth. And so we are piloting a program with the SF LGBTQ Center. I keep adding issues, but I starting to ramp up and start hiring. So if anyone knows anyone that would be interested in doing that work, please direct them to the SF LGBT Center. So, and then the next one is sexual orientation. Again, we had a huge gap in representation in the coordinated entry data versus the PIC count. So 41% of youth in the PIC count identified as LGBTQ, whereas we only got about 12% of youth in access point data who identify on the as LGBTQ. So again, a really huge gap in services, but we do have two LGBTQ surveying organizations represented in the access point, so we're hoping that they will be able to fill those gaps and do more outreach. And that is it. Okay. So next steps, so we have a meeting very much like this one on the last Monday of every month at St. Anthony's, 3 to 4:30, 150 Golden Gate. Refer all youth experiencing homelessness if they don't meet the family definition to one of the access points, or honestly to any access point that they feel comfortable at. Some youth don't want to go to some of the youth serving organizations, and that's just kind of a gap that exists in any system, really. And so this month we're going to begin housing youth in rapid rehousing spots, and I'm so excited. And hopefully, you know, our efforts here will contribute to the 58% reduction in youth homelessness by 2023 that we have as part of our strategic framework. All right. So that's it for me. Any other questions?
Yes, I have a question. So, not related with that, but as connecting to all these pictures. So you guys, you mentioned that you guys opened 5 or 6 new places for youth. And you said that the city and local homeless coordinator, somebody there from HSH, reporting that they opened 7, 8 new navigation centers. So, but we have, in the last 3 years, but we have a homeless shelter family, which is from Friendship, for the last 3 years. So we're demanding HSS and the city to find a place, because the money is there.
For
the place for Friendship.
For youth navigation?
No, for families.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It's first, I want to bring in this picture. It's really easy. In the last 3 years, we're finding places for youth. We're finding navigation services for adults, but nothing for families. So I'm really a little bit weird. How is it possible that we don't find nothing for families? And this is,
yeah, and I hear that, and I think
I am ready to support in this whole process. How we wanna help them to get in a new shelter for these families?
Yeah, so I just wanna to say that there's six access points. So it's, we didn't open 6 shelters. It's just 6 access points where you can go to access coordinated entry. So we actually don't. We have 1 40-bed shelter that is exclusively for 18 to 24. So
yeah.
I hear what you're saying. We definitely don't have the resources to be able to serve every person that we would like to, but thank you for your comment.
And in terms of First Friendship, so that was something that we talked about yesterday also at the FWCP. It is a part of our 1,000-bed project, and so we are looking for a replacement site. Want to acknowledge and recognize that it has been a few years in terms of trying to locate a replacement site, and so I can understand people feeling like impatient of where we are in the process and wanting a clear timeline, but unfortunately we don't have one at the moment because we are stretched in terms of all of the shelter navigation center sites that we're trying to open.
Yes, it's the changing of the guard. Yes, the adult. That's you. Thank you for coming to the adult meeting, not the family meeting. Yes.
Is there any chance I'm going to make the public document so people can understand the criteria and how you help advocate for your client? Because it's kind of like the whole rating, the priority system. Different people have different ideas about it, how you transfer clients from one navigation
So
it's overwhelming to keep calling and asking.
Yeah, a couple things that might help but probably won't cover completely. The population definitions and the homelessness definitions are on the website. The assessment information and questions are on the website. There are a couple of reports about some of the work that was done to develop coordinated entry. The standards are on the website, and we're also working on more documentation on what to expect as people are moving through the process. And DAW technically was its own separate system, so if anything, it should be simpler now that everything's streamlined, but I also hear you that it's not necessarily straightforward to know how to navigate the system as it stands.
Initially, followed an entire acuity, and now I'm being told, well, everyone's the same now.
No, DAW just had different eligibility criteria and was closed to most providers. So, oftentimes people who were highly acute were served through DAW. It wasn't open or equitable to everyone in the community.
I understand that, but now all of a sudden, somebody with DAW now are like low priority. It's even now they're in. These are just some examples of how it's the priority status gets so confusing.
Everyone who was in the active DAW pool was granted priority status through coordinated entry, and basically within priority status, there isn't high or low priority. Everyone is just priority status. So if anything, and I definitely hear you, but this is something that is, so it's been a little bit of a sticking point for me because I worked on it for so long. Right now, their DAW-added services are more accessible to high acuity people who weren't able to access them before. So even though there are still not enough resources to go around for everyone who needs them, they will hopefully be more equitably and justly accessible to people. So, but thank you.
Well, I agree with that. It's just like how then what score do they have now? We're now where are they in the list and what kind of place are they going to get? So the guy's the one who was on DAW and yesterday they told them all they're really on GA housing. I was just gonna ask if there was some like rules or you could follow something or read something about what happened.
So the Paramount Cash Housing is accessible to anyone who is eligible for that specific set of criteria to get in, and actually Wesley can talk to that a bit more than I can. But the key thing with that is oftentimes like if someone's being offered housing through that program, it moves much more quickly. So that's if someone was added to a priority status list via the legacy DAW pool, they would be eligible for any housing, but if they're eligible for the current cash housing, they were being offered that as a quicker solution.
Yeah, thank you.
Did you have any questions?
So I started public comment yesterday that the providers Yes, that is currently being discussed. There has been another meeting that has been scheduled. I just don't remember the date.
Yeah.
Meeting, but it's coming. I would say the last meeting was 2 weeks ago. And there was a couple of meetings preceding that one, so the next meeting was in a couple of weeks. So it is my hope, as I'm sure it's everyone's hope, that we will come to a resolution along that lines. But you're right. We're just here to answer questions. We went over the definitions of homes. So
I saw the attachment.
Yeah. I just want you guys to feel free to ask some questions. Because I'm not presenting any new information on the definitions you went over earlier. Yes, Mary Kate did just mention that the meeting, well, that there was a discussion in progress on the question of pregnancy. And I responded and said, hopefully, when the upcoming meeting, which I think is the 18th, we will propose to do that information. But I don't have any more to offer. And so this meeting involves many of the providers who are providing services for coordinated entry, as well as the various housing programs or homelessness prevention programs, and in representation with HESPA, including the Coalition on Homelessness. And so there's a conversation, so you have folks like HPP, Catholic Charities, Compass, Coalition on Homelessness, Jeff Kaczynski, Megan Owens, who am I leaving out? Elizabeth Medina, in terms of just the one with HSH, because there is, at the same time, there's parallel discussions with staff and the mayor that I haven't participated in, so I don't know who those folks are. So I'm just referring to the folks who've met at HSH and kind of who's sitting around the table, so the audience can get a sense of who's participating in these discussions. Who am I thinking of? Hamilton Families. So Tamika, the executive directors of these programs are participating in discussions. Ellen Hammerly, who is the executive, I think, vice president versus the, and Hilma participated. So it's high-level leadership and very active community representation who's been speaking to these issues for a period of time, who are participating in these conversations in order to come to a resolution on what is a family as it pertains to a person being pregnant. I've only sat in on one meeting. The next meeting will be my second. And again, I think folks are anxious to kind of bring some closure to what the definitions is, which kind of, I think, prompted us finally putting on our website what we know to be true today so that the public can see what we're calling folks who are homelessness and literal definitions of homelessness and the folks that we're serving. So more to come. I'm sure that after the 18th, at the November LHCP meeting, the Monday meeting, there will probably be discussion around that as well. So thank you for bringing that up. Any questions on that? Anybody? And there was a variety. Let me just say this. There's a variety of conversation. Although the conversation, and all of them are quite lively and all of them are quite confident, but the other part of the conversation, including people who are experiencing pregnancy, has to do with folks who are doubled up and whether or not they will be served through coordinated entry. And if so, what is the extent that folks who are doubled up be served through coordinated entry? Meaning, are we talking about families who are doubled up, let me speak to doubled up, who are living maybe in an SRO, who may be living in a garage, someplace that's not legally a home, but who are staying with others, who may have a lease with another person, but they're not staying in their own place. So folks who are doubled up, will they have access to prioritization for shelter? That's part of the conversation. Or will it just be access to the other services excluding shelter? So there's a number of heavy conversations going on that have been going on since I've been involved with the city, so 2017, and I think we're closer than we have been, and I would love to hear public feedback. For those of you who are participating in those conversations, Malia has been a strong and respected advocate for this, and she has a very powerful voice around the
Emily said her organization is serving, and so please feel free to chime in. But these conversations have to be more because when we're talking about defining who gets service, we're talking about who accesses the systems via coordinated entry, what doors they flow through, or which doors they can't flow through, as it pertains to housing, as it pertains to a rapidly housing program, so a permanent housing program like permanent supportive housing, rapidly housing, or transition housing, or as it pertains to shelter. And more specifically, when we're talking about shelter, we're not really talking about our lowest barrier shelter, which is the first one shelter support. Most families are interested in individual room shelter, or even congregate bed shelter, which has a different criteria than the congregate mats, which is first friendship, meaning when someone accesses the shelter system, there's really no criteria, you just show up. But you're sleeping on a mat on the floor, your entire family is sleeping on a mat on the floor. You have some access to case management, you do get meals, but you have to bring your belongings, or you have to put most of your belongings in storage, and then you have to leave early in the morning, and then you have to come back. So most families aren't interested in that type of shelter. But that shelter exists for a very important reason, because the next shelter, and Elizabeth, please feel free to chime in. The next shelter that we have, which is our congregate shelter beds, which is the provider's Hamilton family, we have designed the system to say that, okay, if someone is unsheltered and living on the street, we're going to make sure that they get into the congregate beds. And then from congregate beds or sleeping in congregate mats, you can flow into individual home shelter. But of course, if you're experiencing domestic violence and the system is not able to accept you in, then you will be prioritized for individual home shelter. So these conversations that we're having, that the mayor's office is having, that the key providers in our community are having, that the key community members who are advocating for the families, the adults, and the children who are still having, these are the discussions. Yes, we have, but I'm just kind of awaiting. So what we said on the double L families is that wouldn't be served by shelter, but I would like,
no, what we said was on the agreement is that they will be assessed, mm-hmm. and if any of the other issues, right, the fleeing DV or dangerous situation or non-habitable situation comes to light, they are eligible then for shelter. Same criteria as if you were unsheltered. It doesn't matter that you're coming at that point being in a sheltered situation if you still meet any of the other prioritizations for accessing shelter. But you don't find that information out until you're assessed. So we have working groups that are happening now, coordinating with Megan, to come in and try the assessment out with families so that they can figure out how to really get the best information.
So which assessment are you speaking?
The coordinated entry.
Right, so we're talking two things, right? So when the family...
Assessment for housing.
Right, which is not the same thing as assessment.
Correct, but as part of that process, there is, if information comes up that makes you eligible for shelter, you are to access shelter.
So I'm looking forward to the meeting.
We need to know the information. They are in charge of it.
You know, the city is a large department, and many people take on different roles, and sometimes everyone's not at the table at the same time. sometimes challenging to keep in mind is that you have this thing, and when I first started, I used the analogy of the umbrella of coordinated entry. And everyone is kind of, every program is kind of standing under this umbrella of coordinated entry, because the way you get access to these programs is flowing through the coordinated entry process. So when it comes to communications, when it comes to understanding what various program managers are doing, we meet and we talk about, one, this is what we're doing, and this is how much stuff we do intersect. So quite often, we will participate in each other's meetings. So Elizabeth, for example, has a family shelter meeting every other Wednesday, and I tend to join that. I have a call with the access points every other Friday, and I will invite program managers to join that because the access points have questions, or because the program managers are trying to disseminate information. So at a base level, the program managers are trying to make sure that they're very aligned, because the programs that they're creating, they really need to sync up with the umbrella of coordinated entry, because it's the process by which folks get started. At the next level, of course, you have managers who manage the programs. And so we're having communications, and I'm just going to speak to how I interact with my manager, because I can't speak with the program management, but it's generally the same. So I have conversations with my manager who says, these are the issues that I'm seeing as a result of the policies that I want to create, as a result of the feedback that I'm getting from the community. As a result, this is what I'm hearing families say or adults say. And so there's a conversation that goes on there. There's also what we have called implementation teams, right? And the implementation teams include a variety of folks in the department. They include I forget Abigail's title, but essentially the director of communications. They include the various managers of programs. They include finance. And so we're having conversations around, these are some of the hot policy issues that are going on. Or, for instance, the conversation around pregnancy. This is what's going on. These are some of the, and they learn, these are some of the communications we've been having with various providers. These are some of the communications we've been having with communities. And their goal is to understand the direction we're trying to take a subject, to ask questions, and to get more feedback, to provide counsel. And then that steering committee, as a population, we have a conversation with the executive team, which is essentially the deputy directors and then they hear the decisions that come through the implementation teams, and they provide feedback. And that's generally how information flows through the organization that I can actually go. Now, we also have occurrences, and I'm not typically privy to these incidents, where communities, community advocates, various program leaders from various program providers will also have conversations with the mayor's office, right? And so while various community organizers, advocates, or various community leaders and programs may have their own conversation with the mayor's office, there may be a connection to HSH. Again, I can't really speak to it because I'm not always involved, but just based on this kind of, the one we're talking about for the next meeting, there's a pull-in of the executive leadership at HSH, who then, in parallel, in tandem with what's going on in the mayor's office, has a series of discussions with the community around very important issues, typically issues that have been going on for a period of time. And so then you have a group of people working on it that may or may not include program managers who are working on it at a higher level, because it is something that also we work on in parallel. That's my general understanding. Did I miss anything, HSH staff director? It's okay, I don't know.
I would also say that I would love to help my intervention, and so I'm on the shelter team and interface with like adult shelters, the navigation center program manager, and then there's also a housing team that consolidates like all the housing programs. So it's by population,
we're having much conversations much earlier on with shelter providers, program providers, and access providers in particular, so that they can hear firsthand. This is what we're thinking. We can collect their feedback. We can massage our thinking based on the feedback that we're getting. We also, when it pertains to families, we will ask Elizabeth, can you go to the Family Advisory Council, which is a meeting of families, and say, this is what we're thinking, get their feedback, and incorporate that in the decision making that's going on. So communication isn't just internally. We're really trying hard to make sure that we're working with essentially the directors, the program managers, and the provider agencies so they can understand early on, this is what we're thinking, what is your feedback? And I think that the work that needs to be done that has to be better is pushing down that information in organizations for the case managers of the world, because it does, even in logistics, it does tend to sit at the program manager, the director level, and sometimes the folks who really have doing the work, boots on the ground, they may not hear it as timely as they should, and so there's confusion. It creates chaos in the system, because that information then is given to the family then gives it to another family, and it just cascades out, and before you know it, there's a wildfire of misinformation, because we didn't inform the very people who are working directly with the families quickly enough. So we're really trying to make sure that we make these decisions and get the feedback, so that what we come up with, while we may not be able to agree on everything that people want, we will at least have provided opportunities for folks to say, this is what's important. More important than the client's voice, this is what's important. And we can have a conversation around, this is what HSH can do, this is what coordinators we can do, and this is what we can't do. And then we can go from there. Did you guys want to units, and then they pay a portion of the
Yeah.
that's why, you know, we're required to have.
I feel like we're like, or he's not.
Because there's many in this town who doesn't know, there's so much change going on. And honestly, sometimes a small, especially in our families, it's a small. It's not, I know. That our instruments need to change or something. But that's not, this isn't necessarily.
I'm working on this, which is just, Monday, every Sunday, it's a big event crowd.
I mean, this is, I would love one.